blessings to all of you here this evening. I'm just looking over the crowd and I see a lot of faces that I haven't seen before, a lot of people that I don't know, but a few of you I do recognize, and I know a few of you, and I think it'll be a good weekend. And I just want to say thank you for coming out and joining us here, and I'm sure we'll enjoy the time together. I brought this book up here with me this evening. You all know what it is. It's the Bible. I won't necessarily be looking at it and reading out of it tonight. There'll be some scriptures that I plan to put on the wall up here, but I brought it along mainly to bring out a point, and that is that this is a gift from God, a direct revelation that we can be thankful for, that we don't have to flounder through life wondering what we should do with every turn of the road. Gives a lot of stability to our lives, and it helps us have a sense of purpose and meaning, and it gives us the answer and the key to salvation. But if we don't have this book, if I would set it down here where none of us can see it, and we would have never seen that book in all of our lifetime, then would we still be floundering around with absolutely no direction in life? According to Romans chapter 1, verse 20, it directly addresses these things we're talking about this weekend, and it says that the answer is basically no. That even without the Word of God, God has given enough revelation of things that He's made that we can find our way through His Spirit working through us, and of course, with the aid of the people that witness for Him. So Romans chapter 1, verse 20 says, "For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." So that means that I'm without excuse just by looking at the rocks, the buttercups, the stars, sun, moon, and stars, and all those things. I'm held without excuse before God. So it's a powerful message we can look at this weekend, and so therefore, I think it's really worthwhile for us to come together and look at these things, even though the message we'll be looking at this evening and this weekend is transcended by this book here. We just don't want to undervalue all the revelation that God gives us in the things He's created around us. So it's a real privilege we have to look at these things, and that God has given us a revelation of Himself through the things He's made. Psalm chapter 34, I think it is, says, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt His name together." So you mentioned some about the small things, and when we want to look at the small things, we magnify them. And when we magnify something, we can see it better. And as we magnify the things in the universe around us, we exalt the Lord. So we're going to magnify some of these things with telescopes, and we'll see what God has to show us about Himself through these things. And we'll start off with the topic here, creative creator. And this has to do with the solar system. And we want to see how the solar system shows the glory of God. There's a lot of ways that we can discover kind of some of the characteristics of God and some of His attributes. But one thing that in particular that I want you to notice as we go through this topic here about the creative creator, and we look at the planets in our solar system and the sun as well, I want you to notice how there's a tremendous variety just in these few objects that we'll look at. And so what does that tell us about God? That tells us that He has a wide breadth of creativity, and He is a God who is interested in lots of things and has done lots of amazing things. And that could be a picture of how our relationship is with Him, that it's like it's opened up into limitless possibilities, and a vibrant relationship with our Creator and Savior is what's important for us. So what you're looking at here now is a picture of some of the planets, a couple of the planets, Saturn, Neptune. This is part of the Omega Nebula, part of the Carina Nebula, part of the Orion Nebula, and part of the Omega Centauri star cluster. So these are different parts of space that are brought together and put into one image. You wouldn't get this view by looking through a telescope at just one area, but these are a number of different pictures brought together into one, That's why I have this labeled as a composite, but otherwise it's a real image, or they're made up of real images. That's the reason for the R logo here. So as we go through this weekend, all of my topics, if you see the R logo, you know you're looking at a real image, not just an illustration or something like that. So it's made up of real images here, and this is the background slide for all of the beginnings of the topics. First thing we want to do is get a good impression of how we fit in our solar system and how big the planets actually are. So we'll compare them with each other, but the planets are big, and they're too big for us to really comprehend. So what I'll do is I'll shrink everything down by a factor of 500 million, and we'll make everything 500 million times smaller, and we'll take the Earth and turn it into the size of a quarter. In fact, this quarter right here, we'll just turn that right into the planet Earth, and you can see a quarter-sized Earth illustrated there, about 1 inch across. If we were to go on further in this analogy, the planet Uranus would be 4 inches across, about the size of a softball, like you can see here. This is one of the ice giants. Moving on, we'll come to Jupiter. It's about 11 inches across, about the size of a basketball. It's much bigger than the Earth. It's actually even bigger than it seems here, because you probably heard before, we would be able to put 1,000 planet Earths inside the planet Jupiter if we'd squeeze all the empty space out of Jupiter and replace it with Earth material. So Jupiter is called the king planet. It's a large planet, but it's not nearly as big as the Sun. The Sun is about 9 feet in diameter. In our analogy here, it's taller than the eaves of the house. So you can see the planets are big, but the Sun is even bigger. You could fill the Sun with 1 million planet Earths or 1,000 Jupiters, but the Sun itself, even though it's a big object, it's a big star, it's not the biggest one of them. So I'll just keep on going here so we can get a little better impression of how the planets fit in the broader scope of things in the universe around us. So once we start looking at the stars, then we can say that there are actually small things in the universe, because that would be the Earth, us, and even the Sun can be considered small. Like you said, it's relative. And one of the things that it shows us here is that there are definitely small things in not outer space, but inner space, and I'm one of them. When we look at the immenseness of some of these things, like Arcturus, 234 feet high, about the height of a cell phone tower. In our analogy, if the Earth were the size of a quarter, this is how big the star would be. Rigel would be 700 feet tall, about twice the height of the Statue of Liberty. And if you look close here, you can see the Taurus down here for a size comparison, for a sense of scale. And the next step, we'll be going to New York City. You can see the historic Twin Towers there. Betelgeuse would be 10,500 feet tall, about seven times the height of the historic Twin Towers there in New York City. And this is at the scale of the Earth being the size of a quarter laying on the sidewalk down here, definitely invisible. So what can we say to things like this? It's just mind-boggling to think of how big some of these stars are. This is the star that's in the upper left of the constellation Orion. So Orion's left shoulder. You can see it at night, and if it's in the right time of the year, of course. And it's an orange star. It's fairly easy to see that color. This star is too big for us to really comprehend its size. So what I'll do is I'll take it, and we'll just pretend that we can take the Sun and replace it with Betelgeuse. We'll bring Betelgeuse into the solar system here. This is the Sun. This is the orbit of the Earth, 93 million miles away from the Sun. The Earth goes around the Sun once a year. And Betelgeuse would be large enough, if we would place it where the Sun is now, that it would swallow the Earth's entire orbit, extend beyond the orbit of Mars, and even likely swallow up Jupiter's orbit as well. So Jupiter at night, when you see it at night, the Sun is below us, Jupiter is above us, five times farther away from us than the Sun is below us. But if the Sun were to expand to the size of Betelgeuse during the nighttime, it would grow until it would swallow the Earth and go all the way up and swallow even the star-like object Jupiter out in space. So it's a tremendously large star, but there's other stars that are even bigger, like VY Canis Majoris, which is about 3 miles in diameter, or about four times the span of the Golden Gate Bridge. So one of the things that this shows us is that these stars are declaring the glory of God, and they show how powerful God is and how small we are. We're just tiny. We're one of those little things in inner space. I mean, I'm so little, can you even see me up here? It's amazing how these things can put everything in perspective for us. So now we'll take a look at the solar system, starting with the sun and moving out through the planets. But before we go through those, we're looking at them as a group here. You can see the sun on the left and each one of the planets in order. You can see their size relative to each other, but the distances from the sun aren't correct. So this is correct scale in sizes, but not in distances. The sun gives light and life to these planets, life to the earth, light to all the planets. And the Son of God gives spiritual light and life. So there's some interesting parallels and lessons we can learn from the solar system, parallels with the kingdom of God. So the sun is the center of the solar system. This is another one. The sun is also the center of the kingdom of God. The planets revolve around the sun, just like the lives of God's people revolve around the Son of God. The moon reflects sunlight to lighten the night, and we, as miniature moonlets, reflect sunlight to lighten this dark world that we're in. So it's not just a reflection, though. It's also like an emission or a re-emitting of the light of Christ as he shines into us and through us. Here's a close-up photograph of the sun from a few years ago from one of the telescopes that are in the Celestial Window Observatory there in Montezuma, Georgia. And you can see the size of the sun illustrated as a comparing it to the Earth's diameter. You could place 109 Earths across the face of the sun, or, like I said earlier, you could fill it with 1 million planet Earths. The surface temperature of the sun is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's much hotter in the core of the sun, where the nuclear processes take place. It burns about 600 million tons of hydrogen per second in the core of the sun. So there's a lot of heat and pressure there, and this hydrogen is being crushed together to form helium. And this is a process called nuclear fusion. When hydrogen atoms are crushed together and they form helium, now you have helium instead of hydrogen. So the sun is losing hydrogen at the rate of 600 million tons per second. But most of that mass and that matter stays there. It just turns into something else. But in that matter to energy, in that hydrogen to helium conversion, some of this matter is completely destroyed. It's annihilated. So it goes missing. It doesn't exist anymore because it's turned into pure pulsating energy. And that's where we get the light and heat from the sun. What's amazing is the amount of matter that the sun loses every second in order to support its prodigious energy output. So to illustrate this, we could think of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan back in 1945. It was a terrible event, but it was a time when there were tens of thousands, when the bomb was detonated, there were tens of thousands of lives that were lost from that one explosion. Almost the entire city was leveled because of that blast. It was a tremendous release of energy. Nuclear physicists tell us that if you were to go out in the atmosphere and gather up all the broken pieces of uranium that were used to make that nuclear fission explosion, then you would actually have a little less than what you first started off with. So nuclear physicists tell us that about 2.2 pounds of refined uranium would have split into smaller particles. If we could collect all those, put them on a scale, they say that we would have about 1/30th of an ounce of matter missing, and that's where the energy came from to destroy the city. 1/30th of an ounce of matter, or 0.9 grams, just a fingertip-sized pile of dust. So if there's that much energy in that small amount of raw material, how much energy is in the raw material that makes up your body or this building or this earth that we're on? And how much matter is the sun losing every second? According to astrophysicists, The sun is losing about 4 million tons of matter every second in its matter to energy conversion. So the sun is getting 4 million tons lighter every second, according to our best understanding of how it works, and it's losing an additional 1.5 million tons of matter per second in the solar wind flowing off of the sun. And some of you may have noticed the solar wind and the corona. The corona is caused by that solar wind of particles flowing off of the sun. Some of you may have noticed that in the last eclipse this year, or maybe in 2017. So that's about 1.5 million tons per second coming off of the sun. But there's an additional 4 million tons per second that the sun is losing. But it's no problem because the sun is so large, there's plenty of matter there to keep the sun going for even billions of years, according to what astrophysicists say. So moving on here, let's take a look at a cutaway diagram of the sun. No one knows that the sun looks like this inside, but it's a good little illustration that shows the different parts of the sun. The core, where the nuclear processes take place, there's a convection zone, the radiation zone, and there's prominences out here, sunspots, and we have more of these. We see more of these and coronal mass ejections. And there are sunspot cycles. And you can see those cycles with the blue line up here on the screen. This is a chart of 400 years of sunspot observations. And you see how this line, the blue line, goes up and down, up and down. That's because there's an 11-year sunspot cycle. And you can see it, the peaks and the trough of that cycle. The black line smooths that out and kind of gives an average or a mean of these 11-year cycles. And it shows how that in modern times, we've been having more sunspots in the last 50 to 100 years than what we've had in the past. And this was what was called the Maunder Minimum. And interestingly, it's also a time when Europe recorded its coldest temperatures in the 1650s to 1700 during that Maunder Minimum, the time when the sun was quiet. Here's a photograph of the sun in hydrogen alpha light, and you can see a prominence here. It's about to erupt off of the sun in what's called a coronal mass ejection. And I'm trying to get my cursor over here to where we can see it. Okay, there it is. All right, I'm pointing it out to you here. And what I can do is actually put this into motion, and you can see time-lapse photography causing this to go into motion, and we can see this erupting off of the sun in what's called a coronal mass ejection. So we'll start it now, and at this scale, the Earth is actually would be about the size of my cursor, or even maybe smaller, and it gives you a sense of scale and helps you to see how massive this explosion is, this eruption of matter off of the sun. I'll just play it one more time there. The sun can throw off billions of tons of matter in one eruption when this happens. So the rate of matter leaving the sun is exponentially increased when this happens. And we can see things like the northern lights a couple of days later. It takes on average about 2 days for these particles to get from the sun to the Earth here, 93 million miles away. And they kind of they take the long way to get here because they come to the Earth. The Earth's magnetic field shields us from a lot of those particles of the sun. So the particles strike the magnetic field and they're deflected around. And then these particles find gaps in the field lines behind the Earth. They follow those lines back up and collide with the northern and southern polar regions of the Earth. And they come raining into the atmosphere between the field lines. And we can visualize those field lines then by looking at the northern lights and seeing how that they shimmer and wave across the sky. So this is a picture of part of the sun coming into our atmosphere and energizing it. It causes gases in the air to glow because of energizing them through a process called ionization. I took these pictures in Alaska when we were there a few years ago, and I was hoping I could see northern lights when I went. And sure enough, we were treated to this spectacular view of green curtains of light going through the sky, and it was really amazing to see. But wouldn't you know, just recently here, I was able to see even more down in Georgia, way down south where we don't normally see them. Not only just able to see the common color of green, but also reds, magentas, yellow-green color, and it was just amazing to see. So I'm wondering how many of you saw the Northern Lights just about a month or so ago? Who saw the Northern Lights? Okay, quite a few of you have. Most of you haven't, it looks like, but this is a picture.
It was cloudy.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Everybody else got to see
them. Okay. All right. So this is a view from Georgia, and I was on the phone with Kevin Schenck when some of this was happening, and he said that they were clouded out in Virginia as well, but he said we've got a hole to the south, and we can see the Northern Lights coming through that hole. So it was definitely widespread. And for us down there in Georgia, too, we could be facing north and look all the way up, see Northern Lights to the zenith, and even beyond us, just, I don't know, maybe 40 degrees, 45 degrees off the horizon. So it was quite the amazing sight to see. Here's another photograph of it. You can see the banding of different colors, red, purple, magenta, yellow, green. So it's just amazing to see way down south that far. So it was a treat for us, and it lasted for about an hour that we were able to sit out and watch this light show. You could see pillars of light descending down from high in the atmosphere. These lights are typically about, the bottom of the lights is about 60 miles up, which is about the beginning of space. And the tops of the lights are typically 150 to 200 miles up. So the lights actually appear mostly out in space, but there's just enough of the gases of our atmosphere that are out there that they can glow out there in space. So back to the sun again. Let's take a look at the detail of the sun. This is what's called the photosphere. It's what you see when you look at it, which you shouldn't do. But if the sun is setting low on the horizon, or it's a cloudy day and you can just so see the sun through the clouds, this is the surface that you're looking at. We call it the photosphere. And if we get up close to it, this is what it looks like. This is called solar granulation. And these are made of cells that are about 500 miles in diameter. And each of these cells last about 15 minutes. So they're ephemeral. They don't last a long time. And the reason for that is because the sun is so hot that it's literally boiling. So this boiling action you can see right here, and this is time-lapse photography again, so it's kind of like it's in fast forward motion, and it's about a 5-second video of time-lapse photography that's just playing in a loop. But what's amazing about this is that there's so much energy just seething on the surface of the sun that these cells are rushing upward at speeds of more than 15,000 miles per hour, 500 miles across at supersonic speeds, creating sonic booms as they go and come up and explode outward and then settle down, and other cells come up to take their place. So the sun is this massive, roiling, boiling, seething cauldron of fire up there. It's a thermonuclear furnace. But we can thank God that He created such an amazing, powerful star next to us, and we can enjoy the light and heat. And amazingly enough, in spite of all this activity, the sun is stable. So it's a very stable star. There's other stars that give off extremely large outbursts of energy. For example, Betelgeuse is big enough that we can see, in some of the big observatory telescopes, we can see the actual angular diameter of it. They can zoom in on it till they can see that little pinpoint of light swell up like this, and they can see the size of Betelgeuse. And there are times when it's bigger than others. There are some times when it's about 30% bigger than other times, because Betelgeuse actually swells and contracts and oscillates back and forth. And sometimes huge plumes get boil off the side as big outbursts and coronal mass ejections cast material far out into space. So if the sun would do like that, And you can imagine the trouble it would cause for us here. Okay, moving on. We're going to leave the photosphere and we're going up higher in the sun's atmosphere to the level of what we call the chromosphere. And this picture was taken April 6th to 7th of 2024, which is this year, just a few months ago. And it's a 48-hour time lapse. It was taken by the Solar Dynamic Observatory, which is an observatory that's in space. And it takes pictures of the sun in lots of different frequencies of light. It's continuously monitoring the sun at all times. You can go onto the website and you can see these pictures, and they also put them into 48-hour time-lapse streams that you can see for yourself. And I'll actually play this one right here. So this, you can see the sun slowly rotating, and this is a period of about 48 hours. And it's about to reset itself again. But what you're seeing here is the activity of the lower atmosphere of the sun. It's called the chromosphere. Let me play it again. You can see this during an eclipse. You can see the red glow around the moon. And that's the only time you can see it without a special telescope, because the brilliant white light from the sun overwhelms the red glow that's just above the surface of the sun. So this is the lower atmosphere. Look at all the dynamic activity. And now we will go up one more level, even higher, and you can see other activity. This is the lower corona. This is up a little higher. You can see the coronal loops here. These are magnetic field lines that have come out of the sun, and there's plasma, charged particles that are following those lines. You can see this dynamic activity happening on the sun here in this 48-hour time-lapse photography from April of this year. Another thing that you can notice is that it seems almost like there's a river flowing through here, and there's the polar regions don't seem to be moving or rotating as fast. And that's not just an illusion, it's actually happening that way. I'll play it one more time. So the sun has a differential rotation rate. It's actually rotating faster in the equatorial regions than it is at the north and south poles. And what this does is it causes some problems for the bar magnet structure of the sun. The sun is like a bar magnet. Magnetic field lines are running up and down through it. As the sun rotates in this manner, the field lines get twisted up, and eventually they pop out of the surface and make a loop and go back down again. So as it goes through its cycle, you see more and more of this twisted up nature of the magnetic field lines, and those areas are actually where you see the sunspots then as well. And of course, after that 11-year cycle is complete, the sun resets itself and the field lines get straightened out and the process starts over again. The sun generates approximately 3.8 times 10 to the 26th watts of power. If you're a mathematician, you understood what I said. If you're not, I probably didn't say anything as far as that goes. But we could translate that into 380 septillion watts. So there's the number. It's not a long centipede. It's actually a number describing the power output of the sun. It's too big for us to comprehend, of course. So what we can do is compare it to the biggest accomplishment of man. And what we can do with that is just take a look at the most powerful thing that mankind has ever assembled, and that's a nuclear bomb, a hydrogen bomb to be more specific. And there was a hydrogen bomb weapons test that was done here in the ocean right around this area. And I'll just start it so you can see it here. There's a mushroom cloud that's going up. There's a shock wave moving through the atmosphere. There's a tsunami left behind here that's most likely hundreds of feet high, moving across the surface of the ocean. This cloud here is much higher than the cloud tops over the ocean surface. So it's a tremendous release of energy in this explosion. And of course, these are weapons of warfare, so it's unfortunate that they were developed, or at least for the use that they have. But there you can see it again. shock wave going across the surface of the ocean, through the atmosphere, and we're left with a mushroom cloud now. Tremendous release of energy. But the astronomers or astrophysicists that study the sun tell us that the sun gives off as much energy as 20 billion of these every second. So man's greatest accomplishment is completely dwarfed by what God has right next to us in the sun. But even the sun looks small compared to some of the other things, like the Pistol Star. It's one of the most powerful stars that have been found. It's 10 million times more powerful than the sun and releases as much energy in 6 seconds as the sun does in an entire year. So this is just one of the stars that are out there, and we don't know if this is actually correct or not. Who knows if that is the precisely correct figure. But whatever the case, we can see there's something significant happening here. The star is expelling itself. It's disgorging itself into space as the energy pours out of it, the outer layers of the star being caught up and carried out into space, caught up in that outflow. So the Bible says in Psalm 148, 3 and 5, "Praise ye him, sun and moon. Praise him, all ye stars of light. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for he commanded and they were created." Just by a spoken word. Okay, we're going to have to move through this a little faster now. We're going to start with the planets and move on through. So Mercury is the first planet that we come to after we leave the sun. It travels at 30 miles per second in its orbit around the sun, and that's extremely important. If it were to start slowing down or speeding up, there would be problems for its orbit. It would actually get larger or get smaller. And it has a temperature of 800 degrees in the daytime, 280 degrees below zero at night. There's two reasons for this. One is that it has a long day and night cycle, and the other is that it has does not have an atmosphere to hold the heat during the nighttime, so the heat quickly dissipates away from the planet, radiates out into space. Venus is the next planet that we come to as we go farther out into the solar system. It's called the morning and evening star. It's the brightest point of light or star-like object in the sky. It has clouds that are made of sulfuric acid. It's the same type of acid we have in our vehicle batteries. It has an atmospheric pressure of 1,323 pounds per square inch, which is 90 times greater than the Earth's atmospheric pressure. And it has a temperature of 860 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about twice the heat of a conventional oven. So we have this basically pressure cooker environment with lots of acids. The clouds actually drop acid rain. These clouds are always covering the surface of the planet. And so, of course, that acid condenses and falls down, but it's so hot close to the surface that they believe it vaporizes and goes back into the clouds again. So the atmosphere is this continual circulating bath of acids. We have this tremendous pressure, all this heat, and it's really a terrible place to be. You won't really find astronauts volunteering to go to Venus. If they would, they'd have to make sure it would be well done, or else the astronauts would be well done before they'd get back, which of course wouldn't be a good thing. If we take away all the clouds from the surface of the planet, this is what it looks like underneath. You can see lots of surface features here. The reason we could see those is because there was a spacecraft that was orbiting around Venus, and it had a camera that was able to look through clouds. It was a radar camera, and they were able to see what the surface of this planet looked like. Next is the moon. Since we're skipping the Earth, we'll save that for tomorrow. And the moon, as it comes closer here, you can see it resolving into lots of detail, hidden just under the surface, I guess is the way you could say it. So if you have a chance to look at the moon through a telescope, be sure to take the opportunity, because this is about what you would see if you'd look at the moon through a telescope. You would see lots of craters, you can see mountain ranges, you can see cliff faces, you can see lunar rills, you can see valleys, you can see spires on the moon. So many interesting things to see. Now, unfortunately, when there's more of the moon to see, when the moon is full, there's actually less of the moon to see, because the sun is shining straight down into all these craters, so they leave no shadows. Up here, the sun is shining straight onto the craters, and you don't see them even though they're there. We only start to see the craters when the sun starts shining into an angle down into the sides of the craters. And we definitely see them much better down here along the lunar terminator. So unfortunately for tonight, if we get to use the telescopes, we wouldn't be able to see the craters in this way. But there, the moon, the full moon, has its own attractiveness and mystique. So we'll be able to see some of that, hopefully. And right here you see the Apennine mountain range extending out from the Eratosthenes crater. We can zoom in on that. This picture was taken with the 16-inch telescope you heard about earlier this evening. And there's another heavily cratered region on the right side of the moon. We'll zoom in on that. This is another picture taken by the 16-inch telescope. It's of the crater Clavius. It's kind of a neat thing to look for. A large crater with a semicircle of five smaller craters in the crater floor. So there's lots of interesting things to see on the moon and lots of interesting things to notice about the moon as well. One of those things is that the moon is actually moving away from us. We know that God has created everything with just this clockwork precision. And so we would expect that these orbits are stable, and they actually are. The astronauts that were going up to the moon on the Apollo mission, one of those crews took up a mirror that they set on the moon and turned it toward the Earth. Now today, researchers can take a laser and shine it out to the moon and have that light reflected back to us, and they can time the amount of time that elapses between the time when the laser leaves and when it comes back, and then they can figure out how far the moon is from us with some simple calculations. Well, they've discovered that on average it's getting to be a little farther away every year, and it's just a minute amount. In fact, they say it's about the rate, it's receding away from us at about the rate that your fingernails grow, which equals close to an inch and a half per year. So the moon is moving away from us. And it makes us wonder why. If God placed everything in order and had it so close to being perfect and exactly, precisely coming back to the same place after every orbit, why did he actually allow it to start getting slowly getting bigger? Well, it turns out that God actually did place the moon in a stable orbit, but the reason that the moon's orbit is slowly moving outward, expanding, and energy being added to it, is because it has a continual input of energy from the Earth. And that's because of the Earth's rotation here. The Earth is rotating. So the tidal bulge is pulled forward. That makes a greater gravitational attraction forward than there is back here. So there's less mass here on the Earth, and there's more mass there. So therefore, the moon is pulled forward through gravity. And since there's being more of a forward pull on the moon, then the moon's orbit is slowly getting bigger. So the moon is stealing energy from the Earth as this tidal bulge is being pulled forward. That energy is being transferred to the moon, and the moon's orbit is getting bigger. Now, another effect of this process is that the tides are washing over the Earth as they keep trying to come back to the moon. The tides are actually facing the moon more than what this illustration leads you to believe, but the tidal bulge is just moved forward here in an exaggerated way to give more perspective. But in reality, the tidal bulge is more directed toward the moon, and that tidal bulge moves around the Earth like this, and it keeps the ocean stirred up, and it makes it possible for life to exist in the ocean in the way it does. So it's another way of God's care for this Earth he's created. So there's some interesting history on the moon, as mankind actually made his way out to the moon on December 21st of 1968. This spacecraft that you see here, the Saturn V rocket carrying the Apollo 8 spacecraft and astronaut mission, it was launched from the Kennedy Space Center at 7:51 in the morning, and a man by the name of Frank Borman was in command. And he and the other two men in there were the first humans to ride this rocket all the way to the moon. So they didn't land on the moon, but they circled around it and came back. And they would actually circle the moon on Christmas Eve. And a broadcast was planned for the crew to speak back to the Earth. And NASA estimated that 1 billion people around the world would be listening to this unprecedented event when man actually went to the moon for the first time. So they figured that more people would hear the crew's voices than had heard any voice in all of history. So Julian Scheer, NASA's deputy administrator, gave the crew a simple but imposing instruction, and that was, we want you to say something appropriate. So they kind of left it up to the crew what they would say, but they told them we wanted to be appropriate. So when they got to the point where they took this picture of the Earth coming, rising up around the other side of the moon, they were sending out a message, and they said, we are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send you. They then took turns reading Genesis 1, 1 through 10. So I think that was really interesting and significant that they did that, that they chose the creation account of the Bible to read as they came around the moon in that way. Roughly 1 in 4 people all around the world saw the event and heard them giving that message. Frank Borman, the commander, alone received around 100,000 letters of appreciation for that broadcast. And there was just 34 letters making complaint. So I think this is kind of a window for us into the reality of what people around the world recognize, and even the astronauts and researchers that look into these things, what we all recognize within our hearts, that there is a God and He's the creator of all things. And these things that we see are attributed to Him, and He gets the credit for all these things. And they gave this kind of a broadcast, and they had overwhelming support for it from people all around the world. And then on a subsequent mission, the third mission later, Apollo 11, this is the one where astronauts actually set foot on the moon, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and then they set foot on the moon. But between the time that the Eagle had landed on the moon, that spacecraft landed on the moon, and when they stepped out, they had a few hours there that they took time to do a few other things and get some rest. One of the things they did was they pulled out the wine and bread that Buzz Aldrin had brought along, and they served Holy Communion on the moon before they ever stepped out on the surface. So that's another interesting thing about those Apollo missions. Moving on here, Mars is the next planet that we come to. Its surface contains iron oxide, which is another name for rust. So it's nicknamed the Rusty Planet. In fact, there's so much rust there, you can see it even without a telescope. If you look at Mars at night, it looks like it's orange, and you're looking at the rust. That's why it looks orange. The canyon is 2,500 miles long and 4 miles deep. It's called Valles Marineris. I probably mispronounced that. But it's big enough you can see it from space. It's about 2,000 miles wide, a little over that, actually, about the size of the United States. It has a volcano named Olympus Mons that's 17 miles high, 370 miles wide. It has a polar ice cap up here that shows up in the wintertime for that hemisphere of Mars. And it's cold enough there that the air literally freezes and settles on the surface of the planet. That's dry ice. It's made of carbon dioxide. This is what Mars looks like through a typical small telescope. It's just a small orb of light, and if you look close, you can see a little contrast there showing some surface features. A lot of times you might not even get this amount of contrast between the light and dark areas. But if you have a big telescope and if you have a sophisticated method of photography called lucky imaging, you can take a video of Mars and allow a computer to select all the best images, usually about 10 to 20% of them, and stack them all together, thereby increasing the signal to noise ratio, and you can sharpen the image and you can get a view like this. So this was from the 16-inch telescope back home. There was a camera that was taking 100 frames per second. That's fast enough to freeze the wiggling motion that comes from the turbulence in our atmosphere, making Mars look like a wiggling bowl of jello and blurring all the features. This high frame rate freezes that blurring motion. And then, of course, there was about 2,000 frames that were stacked together out of probably about 10,000 frames taken. The rest of the 8,000 were just discarded. And you can get a good clear view of the planets by using that method. These are some close-ups of Mars from a spacecraft orbiting around it. And you can see black sand dunes here. These are other sand dunes seen from above. You can see how there's stains there. It's believed that there were jets of gases coming out of the sand dunes, staining the surface of the dunes. These dunes have lots of dark streaks. It's believed that these are actually landslides or avalanches sliding down the slopes. And then these winding, twisting streaks of dark are most likely caused by whirlwinds like this, sucking up the light-colored dust, leaving the darker-colored dust exposed underneath. There's lots of interesting things to see on the surface of Mars as well. All right, Jupiter's the next planet that we come to. And as you look at it through a small telescope, this is about what it looks like. You can see Jupiter, and you can see four moons traveling with it. They look like little stars, but they're actually the four Galilean moons. And you notice here, there are two bands of darkness. Those are called Jupiter's equatorial cloud bands. And that's one of the things you can pick out in a small telescope. Another thing you'll notice is how that Jupiter just keeps moving away. And the reason for that is not necessarily because of Jupiter's own proper motion, but because of the Earth's rotation dragging our telescope across the sky. And we have to keep moving the telescope back to get on Jupiter. So this is why tracking motors are useful. Jupiter, in a lucky imaging photography session, can present itself like this. This is that same telescope using 1483 frames just a couple of years ago. You can see the Great Red Spot and one of Jupiter's moons over here and another one over there. And this here is something that's just kind of a fun thing to do if you can do it. Most people can't do it, so if you actually accomplish it, you can give yourself a pat on the back. Or what we're trying to do here is get a 3D view of Jupiter. What I did was I took two pictures of Jupiter about 20 to 30 or maybe 45 minutes apart, and it allowed Jupiter to rotate during that time, and it allows us to have a 3D view of Jupiter with stereoscopic vision. So if you cross your eyes as if you were looking at your nose, you would see not just two images of Jupiter, but you'd see four images. So what you would want to do is cause these multiple images of Jupiter to form three, and the central one is what you'll be looking at. So as you cross your nose, if you were just imagining looking at your finger in front of your nose, and you would actually cross your eyes by looking at your finger or looking at your nose, then these Jupiters will split out into multiple images. Try to make so that you can take those two, bring the two inside ones together, and make them come together into one. And when you do that, it'll pop into a 3D view. But unfortunately, for those of you on the side, it doesn't work for you. And apparently, Andrew understands how this works because he moved over here and now he can see it better. So if you're at the side, one, okay, good. If you're at the side, you're looking at it from an oblique angle and one is actually bigger relative to the other, so your brain can't really merge it right. It's like looking through binoculars that's out of collimation, similar to that. So that gives you a 3D view of Jupiter. And then we have another view of Jupiter here. This is from a spacecraft. Gravity on Jupiter is 2.4 times stronger than Earth's gravity, which means that a 200-pound man on Jupiter would weigh 200-pound man on Earth, if he were to go to Jupiter, would weigh 480 pounds. Not necessarily a place to go if you're on the Weight Watchers Club, of course. The rotation speed is 29,000 miles per hour at the equator, and it bulges for this reason. It's spinning so fast, it's 29 times greater than the Earth's 1,000 mile per hour rotation speed. So for this reason, Jupiter bulges and it's about 6,000 miles more distance from the east to the west side than it is from the north to the south pole. The Great Red Spot is a perpetual storm that's been there ever since astronomers were looking at Jupiter through telescopes. It's a huge storm, as you can see there, and I see the time now, so we're just going to have to jump through this, and you can look at the pictures as we go. There's a volcano that's so big it's spewing lava into space, as you can see, hundreds of miles high on one of Jupiter's moons. Jupiter causes ground tides on some of its moons. The moons are turning themselves inside out, especially Io. This is Saturn. That's Saturn through the 16-inch telescope. And this is a picture of it through a spacecraft. The rings are made of ice particles. Lots of interesting things to see on Saturn. Saturn would actually float if you'd have a body of water large enough. The rings are made up of hundreds of individual ringlets. There's lots of interesting views you can see of Saturn and its moons and its rings. There's geysers coming off of some of Saturn's moons. Lots of interesting things to see on the moons around Saturn as well. There's these planets. Actually, I think this is probably counterproductive to just flip through all this so fast, so I'll just stop this instead of trying to flip through all those things, and we'll just go straight to the end and summarize it here with Psalm 33:8-9, where it says, "Let all the earth fear the Lord, let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him, for he spake and it was done, he commanded and it stood fast." So all of these phenomenal things he created. And he did it just by speaking the word. How amazing is that?